This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And it's really great to be back with you again. I want to remind those of you listening on radio, you can also hear us commercial-free online webcast at promiseoftomorrow.biz. We have an exciting show today. We have Colonel Andrew Pennington, and a little later on in the program, Shawalu. And we'll visit the Dennis Strangers, visit our Fountain of Useless Information we keep here on the set, and of course at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. So we're covering the speakers at MetroCon, and a fascinating person is Colonel Andrew Pennington. He serves in the U.S. Air Force Reserves as an individual mobilization augmentee to the Director, Air and Cyberspace Operations, Pacific Air Force. And in civilian life, he works for Gartner as an executive partner. Today, he's speaking with us as neither one of those positions, but rather as a person making a presentation at MetroCon. And we're very, very happy to have him. Welcome to the program, Colonel Pennington.
Well, thanks, Colonel. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be here.
Your topic, as I understand, is going to be UAS vulnerability to cyber warfare, and we should explain to the listeners that UAS is unmanned aircraft system, and I would appreciate it if we could differentiate here and explain to us the difference between an unmanned aircraft system and an unmanned aircraft vehicle. How do we differentiate those two?
That's a great question, Colonel, because it really comes down to the key of what you're trying to protect. And when we talk about a UAS, or unmanned aircraft system, we're talking about both the aircraft system as well as the ground control station components. So with the unmanned aircraft vehicle, which we use the acronym UAV for that, some people, particularly say the Air Force, uses the term RPV, remotely piloted vehicle, because they like to give confidence that there's a pilot behind the system.
Okay.
But basically, when we're talking about a UAV, we're talking about the aircraft itself, the base system that goes with the aircraft system, the communication links, the sensors or payload on the aircraft, the avionics. We're also talking about weapons that might be attached to the aircraft and any autonomous control systems. On the other side of it, the ground control station, we're dealing with the actual physical operators. We refer to them as operators instead of pilots on the UAV systems. And also the specific communications links that provide backhaul communications from the UAV ground control station into other networks.
Okay, so is this... This would include, but not be exclusive to what we civilians would known as drones. Is that right?
That is right. Most people do call these drones. It was a term picked up in World War II. For instance, you would have the drones, the old buzz bombs that would attack. Of course, with the new unmanned aircraft vehicles that we have out there, you actually have a pilot that can redirect the system versus a system that's more or less a guided missile that's out there. But you also have three primary components that you'll see that you wouldn't see on what we originally called drones back in World War II. The most important one is the command and control link, and the second one is where you're getting information back from the drone, which is telemetry and tracking information. And then the third primary component, of course, is the data payload, or in some cases you might actually have a weapons payload.
All right. That's really interesting because it shows the complexity of the whole drone operation, so that it's you can't just call it a drone. I guess we have to call it a UAS. Now then, your subject is going to be on the vulnerability of UAS to cyber warfare, and I could imagine that could be a real challenge. After all, cyber hackers have been confounding us in so many ways all the time, and so one would suppose that the next step would be to one of our unmanned vehicles that is carrying weapons and taking out terrorists. So give us a synopsis of what you're going to be talking about at the Metricon conference.
Well, sure. I think the first thing to do is just start off with an example. I think one of the more popular examples that was picked up in the press was when the United States lost an RQ-170 Sentinel back on the 4th of December, 2011. Mm-hmm. And I think that received the most amount of press because Iran claimed that they were able to hack into the system and actually fly the drone to a successful landing, more or less, and completely take over the system. Another well-publicized event occurred back in September of 2011, where there was what was referred to as a keylogging virus that infected the United States UAV fleet at Creech Air Force Base, which is more popularly known as the best example, perhaps, of a cyber attack. So with those two examples getting out in the press and then a couple of other researchers coming out and saying that they've been able to break into the command and control systems of drones, it's generated a lot of concern in the public, worry that the drones are actually safe. The whole idea behind having a drone up in the air is that you have to see it go over and feel confident that it's going to take off from where it's intended to take off and land where it's intended to land and not interfere with anything along the way. So the whole issue of cybersecurity has to do with securing that aircraft from the point that it takes off around its entire line of flight until it finally lands. And that's a rather large area that you have to cover to provide cybersecurity over.
Well, now, I presume that the security for these vehicles is encryption. Is that where I'm going with this, or where are we going with this?
Well, it depends. We have to go back and look at the fact that there's many different types of drones. In the larger systems, if you're looking at a Global Hawk, you're looking at a large global surveillance system that's about the size of a civilian airliner, say a 777. If you go back in terms of weight, wingspan, that type of thing, those systems have very complicated payloads. They have very complicated communication systems, and they're quite capable of carrying the encryption capability on board and also having the encryption capability in the ground control stations. The data links as well are encrypted as you're moving data from ground control stations via satellite or radio links to the aircraft. On the far end of the other spectrum, you have micro UAS systems, which are under 4.5 pounds. You also have what are becoming most prevalent, which are the hobby UAS systems that we're seeing pop up all over stadiums, pun intended there, and at sporting events, weddings, things like that. Those smaller systems typically don't have encryption. They're more or less standard aircraft that are radio-controlled type aircraft, and they actually operate on common frequencies, and you can go in with the hand controller from a commercially purchased system and actually go out and take over someone else's just by flipping to the same channel.
Oh, wow.
So there's you have that entire spectrum in between, of course, of vehicles that are the size of VW bugs or, cars, and you have much intermediate systems that are about the size of a lunch table.
Whoa, boy, oh boy! this is really something. And then we hear about them violating airspace, like around the White House and the Capitol building not too long ago, and some other things. If it's that easy to command one of these systems, where's the safety to all this?
Well, I think the real question is what's practical, what's reasonable, what's your expectation? And quite frankly, you have to look at a range of systems that goes well beyond just aircraft. For instance, you also have hobbyist radio controlled cars. You have maritime unmanned craft that could also be commandeered or that could be used. The need for cybersecurity is, you know, omnipresent across all of those systems. I think what you really have to do is to consider where you're going to develop standards that those systems will adhere to. And right now on the larger system, you can feel quite safe that a Global Hawk, a Predator, a Reaper, the military systems in particular, you know, they're designed with the idea that they will be attacked. And they're designed with security in mind from the onset. And adding security to those systems via encryption and other types of security controls is actually part of the system design lifecycle when those systems are created. What we found down the smaller side is that a lot of people are creating aircraft or other type of vehicles and then adopting various control systems to go with them based on cost efficiency and availability versus starting with the idea that you're going to secure the system up front. And one of the precepts of cybersecurity is that when you design security into the system, it lowers the cost and provides security throughout the life cycle of the system. But when you go back and try to add it as an afterthought, it generally is nowhere near as effective, and it's much, much more expensive.
Okay, so standardization is what you are calling for and what other people are calling for as being necessary across the whole spectrum of unmanned vehicles. Is that right?
Well, certainly. I mean, think about your own house. If there was a realtor launching a UAV and it's flying around your neighbor's backyard, wouldn't you feel a lot safer knowing that that system had been designed according to federal regulations and federal specifications that say that the system cannot be commandeered so it won't come plopping on top of your head or going through your window?
Yeah, I have a 20-gauge shotgun with a full choke used for turkey hunting that I'm keeping birdshot in specifically for the purpose of when the drones fly over my private property. It's a scary frontier. Of course, we've been told for a long time that it's a brave new world out there, that we're going to be getting a whole lot of things that maybe make us quite uncomfortable. But I think the drones are one thing that is a big concern to an awful lot of people, the loss of privacy, the dangers, and the other things that are involved. How close are we then to having these standards? Is this something that's going to have to be passed by Congress?
Well, they're in works right now, and the FAA admittedly has been taking a long time to develop the standards. I have to say that they're doing what they can to get it right. But what's been thwarting the FAA has been what we were talking about originally, which is the fact that there are so many different sizes and types of UASs. And there's actually confusion over the different categories of UAS systems that are available. So, for instance, we used to call them Group 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and then we moved to Tier 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We categorized based on weight, then we categorized based on size, then we categorized based on capability, and now we're finally starting to come out with standard categories, and that's usually what the FAA uses. In regards to privacy, I feel strongly that we need to do everything we can to secure the privacy of individuals, to make sure that drones don't become so all-inclusive or intrusive in our lives, I should say, that we're going to see them everywhere we go. But we also have to keep in mind that every day you're passed by a car that could contain a camera. Every day a few airplanes fly over your head that could contain cameras or surveillance equipment. And quite frankly, I go out, and I've been a private pilot my entire life. I mean, I have circled over neighborhoods or houses just examining the real estate or something like that. You could easily load up, for instance, a small Cessna 150, one of the smallest commercial airplanes you can get, and load it full of surveillance and communications equipment, and you could have been doing that for the last 60 years and doing much more surveillance than you could do with a small drone that's only a few pounds. So the issue of privacy and the issue of surveillance has been with us for many years. What we have to do now is apply those same laws to ensure that we receive the same security and the same privacy that we receive by saying that you can't do those things with manned aircraft. But the reality of it it's always been with us since we've had aircraft. And the first aircraft that were built were designed for reconnaissance and surveillance, all the way back to the Wright Brothers aircraft that were designed for the Army.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those who have been guests on the program that specialize in satellites tell me that the optics are so good now that from a satellite they can drill down to very, very fine surveillance on Earth, you know, even from space. So, you know, your point is very well taken. But getting back to other concerns about these drones, in Turkey this past week, there was a peace rally that a couple of suicide bombers got in and blew up and killed a couple of score of people, and it was pretty heinous. And the suicide bomber seems to be a pretty popular thing right at the moment all over the Middle East and, of course, other places. And, of course, we had the bombing at the Boston Marathon here a couple of years back. So I would think that the drones could maybe be a replacement for suicide bombers. They won't have to commit suicide any longer. Just drop a drone with the explosives in the middle of a crowd, and there you go. Is that a concern, too?
Well, I can tell you that personally I was in downtown Austin last year, and I was attending a conference on all things of cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened that President Obama was visiting the same hotel that I was in on the ground floor. And I thought it was kind of interesting because I was up on the second floor in a conference area, and at the time he arrived in his limo, we were surrounded by Secret Service. They were all around the windows between us and between the curtains and the windows in our conference room. If you went out and actually looked outside off the balcony of the hotel we were at, we were surrounded by Secret Service for blocks. And because I have a background in UAS, it just occurred to me that anybody could take a small quadcopter and put a small explosive charge on it, and the Secret Service would basically be relying on their handguns to try to shoot the thing down if they even saw it coming. Mm-hmm. So I was very concerned about the safety of the president and the safety of other people in situations as you just described. So that really comes down, that brings us back to where we started, which is the cybersecurity of the UAS and why would you actually try to attack a system? And there's a couple of different reasons. One of the main reasons you'd make a cyber target out of a UAS is because you just want to steal the system. I mean, some of these systems are worth minimum hundreds, but typically thousands and sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars, so you might want to just steal the system by taking it over. As you mentioned just now, you could also perhaps convert a drone into a missile, something that we would see, for instance, in what we saw at 9/11. You could also commandeer the drone and use it for your own purpose. For instance, you could take over somebody else's $200,000 investment in an aircraft and steal the imagery off of that. That coincides also with the idea of data and intelligence theft. So you could just steal the imagery or intelligence for the aircraft. I know one area that when I was working for an engineering firm in the past, we were really concerned with was Department of Homeland Security flying drones over hurricane-ravaged areas or disaster areas such as we're seeing right now in Carolina, and having that imagery susceptible to interception by news media or other sources where you didn't want to have any interference with rescue operations, but the imagery might be taken and misused, or it might be publishing, unfortunately, a death or an injury of someone before a family is notified, things like that. Mm. But just to complete that list, you could also, target UAS because you want to defeat the surveillance and reconnaissance capability of the aircraft. So let's say that you're a police officer flying a small drone and you're trying to follow a car with it. That would be a lot safer to launch very quickly a small drone out of the back of a police car versus having a police car have a high-speed chase.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, so you can see the advantage to that, but then if you're a criminal or perhaps a narcotics smuggler and you see that drone overhead, you might do a cyber attack to defeat it. And I think that's where we're going to see the biggest emphasis on trying to attack some of the smaller drones that are specifically built for law enforcement. And then the last thing that I would put on there is that you might target an unmanned aircraft system because you view it as an entry point into an intelligence network. Because all of these drones, when they're actually gathering imagery, they're going to download it into storage or send it directly onto an intelligence network or intelligence dissemination network that's typically an IP-based network. Mm-hmm. And this would be because of the vulnerability of the systems and their exposure. It's very easy to get, not very easy, but it's typically easier to get into that than, say, it would be to hack your way into a system that's locked in a data processing center in a building. So I just kind of wanted to cover, there's a number of reasons you might do a cyber attack. The one that we talked about, converting the drone into a missile, once again, if a dedicated person wanted to go take over an aircraft or something, they can lease aircraft, they can purchase aircraft, they can try to break their way through TSA secured airliners. There's a number of different ways people can do that, and the idea is that the FAA and law enforcement just has to anticipate that and get on top of it, and that's basically what TSA is all about, trying to prevent those type of things from happening in other airport security. So we have to include the UAS within that existing umbrella and the existing policies and laws that we have, including the privacy laws, and make sure that the safety of the public is continued using those existing laws and furthering those laws where necessary.
Yeah, I was always going to envision the terrorists getting several drones together with their explosives and attacking our power grid in various different places so that there could be a cascading power failure like what happened, in 2002 in the Northeast from just a limb falling on a power line in Ohio. And of course, the power companies are saying, well, we've got all this redundancy right now. It isn't going to happen. But if you take, let's say, a dozen drones loaded with explosives and hit key areas, maybe a cascading power failure could occur. And so how do we protect ourselves against these things?
Well, that really goes back to how you're going to overcome the entire cyber threat that, and I want to be, before I go much further, I'd like to say this. There's a lot of confusion over what is a cyber attack on an unmanned aircraft system and what is an electronic warfare attack.
Okay.
So with the cyber attack, what we're basically doing is we're talking about protecting the information that a drone is processing or the information system itself, the entire drone, from any unauthorized access, unauthorized use, disclosure of information, disruption of the operation of the drone, modification of it, or actual destruction of the drone. If you're talking about electronic warfare versus cyber attack, you're looking at targeting the radio frequency channels, you know, for jamming, targeting the GPS systems, navigation aids, and you can even get into including electromagnetic pulse weapons and stuff that actually try to take out the aircraft. And other things you can do, such as Meekening electronic warfare attack, where you can take control of or basically misguide an unmanned aircraft system by pretending to be a navigation aid. And there are some people who have said that that's a cyber attack, but it's really an electronic warfare attack in the industry vernacular. So to answer your question with those things in mind, when we look at a cyber attack and how do we address that, how do we overcome it, the way to do that is to do what we do with any other system that processes data. And that's to apply the risk management framework. The first step of that is to identify what vulnerabilities.
Okay, hold that thought. We'll be right back. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Adelaide Stevenson. What a man knows at 50 that he did not know at 20 is, for the most part, incommunicable. The knowledge he has acquired with age is not the knowledge of formulas or forms of words, but of people, places, actions. A knowledge gained not by words, but by touch, sight, sound, victories, failures, sleeplessness, devotion, love, the human experiences and emotions of this earth and of oneself and other men, and perhaps, too, a little faith, a little reverence for things one cannot see.